be read by a common populace star for heroics. The confidence with which Elvis knifed my brother's honor left my mouth dry. Israel Finch grew into a lost boy of great promise, who, despite his broken home and juvenile record, showed natural talent in the areas of negotiations and auto mechanics. And Tommy Boska, Elvis's ace. Tommy was just some forlorn kitten, out mewing in the dark and the cold and the rain. Through all this, I gaped occasionally at Swede, who appeared snake-bit and vengeful. Then up stood Mr. DeQuayer to respond. I don't remember his words, but in general feeling, well, remember how the great Daniel Webster argued against the devil for the soul of Jabez Stone? The devil had him beat, you recall, as long as Webster stood on logic. You can't argue with a signed contract, and Jabez, the dolt, had signed. But Webster saw victory in the devil's face and in the faces of that hellish jury, the whole lot of them leaning forward, licking their lips. And he calmed himself and began to speak instead about what makes a man, and the nature of the soul, and its very creator, whence comes all freedom, and so on. And the devil himself did wither in the face of this bigger logic. And so, it seemed to me, must Elvis wither, and judge and jury also, when Mr. DeQuayer had finished his wise and simple statement. They didn't seem impressed, though. In fact, there came some fairly bad moments after that. One came when Elvis called Stanley Boska to testify. Till now I'd thought I had the facts by the tail. Wasn't I an eyewitness? But Stanley had been treasuring up a zinger to impart to the court. Davy came around to Finch's place that night. Rotten night out. 9 o'clock or thereabouts, Stanley said. Did you see him yourself? Yes, sir. It was Davy Land. I was over to the Finch's looking for Tommy. He was all the time over there. They were best friends? Your Tommy and Israel Finch? Stanley nodded. Swede later suggested this was because he didn't want to admit it out loud. And what did you see Davy do? Well, he had something in his hand. A tire iron, I guess, or a pry bar? Hard to tell in that rain. Anyway, he whacked every window out of the Finch boy's car. You're saying Davy Land came to the Finch residence with a tire iron? Or a pry bar, could have been. And smashed out the windows of Israel's car, in which the boy took inordinate pride? Well, yes, sir. And the taillights. He got those, too. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to make a practice of this transcription business. But as I said, there were salient moments. Those gathered stirred audibly. A surprise revelation. Here is what they'd come for, all right. For me, of course, the surprise quickly deadened into a recognition that it was perfectly true. Swede and I had gone to bed early. So had Dad, on account of his headache. Davy'd gone out into that freezing rain, and later, when I thought him asleep, when the footsteps entered our house, wasn't I amazed when the lights came on, and there he was, sitting upright, holding his Winchester as if he'd taken it to bed. Of course he had taken it to bed. I saw it now. He knew they were coming. He'd issued them an invitation. I looked at Davy's face, couldn't read it, and looked at Dad's, seeing not shock, but sorrow and austerity. Evidently he knew about this. I checked Mr. DeQuayer. He knew it too. At that moment a wall inside me shifted. Gravity took hold, and I knew my brother had no chance inside that courtroom. Piece by piece, our defensive architecture failed. Marjorie Boska testified, the tears standing in her eyes, how poor Bubby had gone to the store for her twice a week, getting the bread and milk and on occasion a dozen eggs, doing his uncomplaining best. Yellow-eyed old Mr. Finch, Israel's grandfather, it turned out, told in quiet convulsive tones how Israel was without doubt the most maligned and abominated young man in roofing. He didn't make friends that well, etc. His voice left him after just a few moments. Elvis graciously articulated the old man's powerful, if obscure, emotions, then released him to go wrestle the tormenting ague. Davy's erstwhile girl, Dolly, was sworn in, throwing tragic looks at him, and recounted her experience in the locker room. It clearly troubled her to do so, for she understood the use Elvis was making of her. establishing for the jury the extant hate between Israel Finch and Davy. Coming to Dad's part in it, though, she may have eased the damage. How was a court of law to take her description of his luminous appearance? Peeking at the jury here, I saw most of them were studying Dad, possibly for radiance, or a look in his eye, or other unnatural credentials. All this time, I was fighting a magnificent swarm of butterflies. Mr. De Cuellar had told me I'd have to testify as the single eyewitness of the shootings. He didn't tell me the prosecution was saving me for last, my story being useful in throwing away the key. But Swede had figured it out and didn't spare me the knowledge. In craven dread, I sought Swede's help in rewriting the events to Davy's advantage. But Mr. De Cuellar reassured me, saying to be honest and forthright, though frugal in detail. "Answer only the question," he said. "Short declarative sentences, no big prose." Well, he didn't have to worry about that. Who did he think I was, Swede? Anyway, I hadn't a lot of choice, and Mr. De Cuellar promised to fix my mistakes in his cross-examination. I remember wondering, with the whole day still between me and the stand, whether the whirl in my stomach might be a blossoming case of flu. Surely they would excuse a witness who was busy throwing up. I worked at it a while, remembering something Peter Emerson had told me, that if he thought hard about puking, or better yet, remembered instances of his older brother puking, he could just about bring up the real thing himself. I shut my eyes. Once in school, going down to lunch from our third-grade classroom, Valentino Vale had leaned over the banister without warning and loosed a cataract of orange vomit. The stairway was the usual open stack, and Valentino's breakfast just dropped forever, three stories down, touching a good number of lives as it rocketed past and hitting the basement tile with the sound zookeepers must hear sometimes, around the elephants. I was right behind Valentino and saw it all, an astonishing puke that was discussed for days. Yet even this, vividly invoked, could not move my stomach to violence. I envied Peter's mental potency. "We're gonna lose, Reuben," Swede told me that night. We were socked into sleeping bags on the floor of Mr. De Cuellar's study. Though the day had been troublesome and the night was black with a racketous wind, still I found this small library a reassuring place. How could anyone who'd read so many books lose a case in court? Then I remembered Stanley Bosca and the way Elvis had turned righteously toward the jury during his testimony, and I agreed with Swede, though not aloud. She then said, "We've got to break him out." I should have known it was coming. "Oh, Swede, don't now." She sat up in her sleeping bag. "We could do it. Bust him out of there. Really, tonight." She had hold of my shoulder. "I'm not kidding." "I know it." She was up, patting around. "They're going to convict him, Reuben. You see it same as I do. You want Davy in prison?" Gus gnashed at the window. I said, "We can't even drive, Swede." But it carried no water. She paced in the gloom, full of deadly schemes. "We'll wait till they're asleep. Take some of Mrs. De Cuellar's cookies. Offer them to the guard. Tell him we've got to see Davy. When he turns to me, you grab his gun." And so on. It was one of those rare moments when I actually felt older than Swede. Seizing it, I told her to grow up. She went silent and fell to studying bookcases. Mr. De Cuellar had left a reading lamp on in a corner as a nightlight. Had he children of his own, he'd have known better. And it so illumined the room, I could read the spines from where I lay. C.S. Lewis, Graham Greene, Charles Dickens, lots of Dickens. She returned to bed at last with a book of poems by Robert Louis Stevenson. I said, "Read me a couple, Swede." Few writers can match Stevenson. Both danger and peace inhabit his verse. It throws a very wide net. So Swede laid beside me, reading Land of Nod, My Ship and I, Northwest Passage, and The Lamplighter, with its wistful narrator. "But I, when I am stronger and can choose what I am to do, O'Leary, I'll go round at night and light the lamps with you. My heart still breaks with that poem. I love it so. Then Swede was quiet some little time. I wasn't asleep yet, but was on the doorstep, a dream just opening up. Listen to this one, Reuben. I opened my eyes. She was propped on an elbow. Sleep already had me in the legs and arms, but Swede looked bright and scared. She read, "Whenever the moon and stars are set, whenever the wind is high, all night long in the dark and wet, a man goes riding by." Goose flesh rose. Outside, the wind thumped around. The reading lamp flickered but stayed on. She whispered, "Late in the night when the fires are out, why does he gallop and gallop about?" I said, "Let's sleep, Swede." Though I couldn't have, not anymore. There was a prescient chill in those lines, in her voice. "Whenever the trees are crying aloud and ships are tossed at sea, by on the highway, low and loud, by at the gallop goes he. By at the gallop he goes, and then by he comes back at the gallop again." Had I not been 11, I'd have squirreled down and drawn the sleeping bag up over my head. Maybe you're thinking there's nothing creepy about this particular poem. I'm telling you, that night there was. But Swede was watching me for reaction, so I just yawned, a big fake one, and asked, was that the end? "It's a sign," she said. Which, of course, put a keen point on the vague dread I was feeling. You don't like to say it's a sign at such times, or hear it, or even think it, for fear the words themselves will bear it out. "What does it mean?" I asked. "I don't know." She shut the book and turned out the light and waited a while and then said, "I think it means we ought to break him out." Next afternoon, they put me on the stand. I felt like a parakeet up there. New chinos, a green wool sweater that itched at the neck, my hair slicked to pudding. I looked at Dad, who smiled back, at Dr. Noakes, who winked, at Swede, who was leaning forward, pestering Mr. De Cuellar in the moments before swearing in. I laid my hand on the Bible, and when finished, looked at Davy, who was straight across the floor. He was making faces, trying to bust me up, just like back in church. Now be warned. I must witness here against myself. And so, as a human brimful of vainglory, may attempt excuse. If so, pay me no mind. The fit will pass. Elvis came up in his bow tie. He asked some chatty questions about school, friends, bullies, stuff I like to do. It irritated me, for I knew what he was up to, getting me comfortable, warming the clay. Also, showing the jury how concerned and thorough he was by getting on good terms with Davy's kid brother. Patronizing was the word Swede used later, though by then I was too mortified to ask anyone exactly what it meant. But I was properly terse. I looked him in the eye and answered him straight. And when he came to the end of his getting-to-know-you questions, what he and the court mostly knew was that he hadn't got to me with his smiles and joshing. This was one 11-year-old who'd never take sides against his brother. I gave him nothing at first, I promise you. But gradually, oh, it hurts, something began to work on me. I began to have, of all things, self-confidence. It crept up like an oily friend. It seemed to me that Elvis began to look less certain of himself, walking to and fro. Clearly, he'd expected I'd be putty by this time, and my own voice sounded particularly grown up, I thought, saying, "No, sir, that's not so," or, "Sir, he's my brother, I ought to know." I sirred him to death. I sirred him with a disrespect he had to comprehend. And hearing these things from my own mouth, I thought, not bad. Pride is the rope God allows us all. When Elvis asked if I'd had scary dreams since the night these things transpired, I replied, "Certainly not, sir," with what I imagine was the hauteur of a condemned legionnaire. Of course, hauteur is an odd adornment on a boy that age, but oh, that gallery of faces all watching me. Faces of friends and erstwhile friends, of interested strangers, of newspaper men. They were my sun, my water. I remember hoping unreasonably that Bethany Orchard was there watching And in fact, I did look for her with such concentration that Elvis had to beg my pardon to bring me back. At some point, I looked at Mr. De Cuellar and saw alarm in his eyes. I actually wondered what was wrong, which tells you how far gone I was. Then Elvis, who had been working his way forward from the locker room incident, said, "Reuben, the night the boys came by and took your sister for a ride?" A ride. How do you like that? "What happened that night? Before the sheriff arrived, do you remember?" As if I might have forgotten. As if the chill of Israel Finch's intrusion wouldn't be forever as close as air to skin. Memory chasing pretense for a moment, I said, "Well?" Swede was white, and she looked real small.
"Small?"
"Yes, sir. Usually she's as big as me." In retrospect, it was as telling a statement as I ever made. It also produced an audible ripple of goodwill for this youngster on the stand. Immediately I felt reduced, from budding hero to guileless moppet. Elvis turned to the gallery and made the most of it, and I'm ashamed to say how his doing so tweaked my attitude. Having lost ground here, I ought to have simply dug in, humbled and held my new position, but I'd become a proud twerp over the preceding 15 minutes. Turning back to me, Elvis smiled. "Reuben? Was Davy angry that night?" He thought I was hesitating out of fear to answer the question. I confess to you now I was only looking for the right voice. Something legionnaire-ish. Oh, I still wanted to do my best by Davy. I hadn't forgotten him. But I wanted to sound smooth doing it, you see. Like a hot shot, Mighty Stinson would have said. Elvis prompted, "Something like that happening to his little sister? Say, I would have been upset, a thing like that." Reaching down for a good low register, I replied, "No, sir. Davy was as easygoing as anything." And truly, that's how he'd been. Not pale and dry with fear like Swede and me, but calm, with a stillness that was itself fearsome. Except, on easygoing, my voice slipped back into its normal range, or possibly a little higher. I discerned snickering. Again, I was ridiculous before my public. Then Elvis said gently, "Now, Reuben, haven't you told us how your brother sticks up for you, protects you?" I had. "And now you're telling us he didn't have a thing to say after Tommy and Israel brought her home? Scared as she was by those boys, and Davy just sitting quiet?" Posed like that, it did seem unlikely. I thought it over, sensing the court waiting. Davy had said something, hadn't he? Just before Ted Pullett drove in? I looked at my brother, there in the courtroom, and tried to recall. And you know, when Davy looked back, something was different. Something in the look itself. It was untethered somehow. Loosed from Elvis and the jury and the judge. He smiled at me from some planetary distance. And I thought of his way in the kitchen that night. How he'd hooked the car keys on his finger and yielded them to Dad wordlessly. After a long and inner weighing, and I remembered.
"Why, yes, sir," I told Elvis. "He asked Dad a question. He said, 'How many times do you let a dog bite you before you put him down?'"
And the court did not erupt, nor the jury gasp in wonder at this revelation. Only Elvis's eyebrows rose slightly, and, "Reuben," he said, with such gentle approval my blood gelled to a stop, "you've been holding out on us." That night I agreed to break Davy out of jail. Swede knew I would. She had on her side the fact that I'd as much as damned our brother to prison, and therefore death, for he would die there, or some core inside him would. We lay awake while the adults spoke in counsel long and low in the kitchen, and Swede laid our plans. Desperate, slapdash, bloody plans. I was in no position to propose alternatives. I never saw her so upset or brilliant. She was like a horse, let out to run. I did make one suggestion, about guns being better than knives for the work at hand. She shook her head in great regret. "They don't have any guns. I looked everywhere. Poor Mr. De Cuellar," she added. "Someday I'm going to buy him one." Yes, poor Mr. De Cuellar. After my damaging performance, I'd been unable to avoid his eyes, and the sorrow and disappointment they showed were as if I'd struck him in public. I tried to apologize and broke down before him, and his forgiveness was so quiet and complete I could only grieve the more. And why, you're wondering, did I toss Elvis that line of Davies about putting down the dog? Well, I suppose I had to, once I'd gone and remembered it. Elvis had asked me the question, and I was tied to honesty by oath. A person can't regret honesty any more than other unavoidables. A plain face or a poor history. What I regret is how I said it. Like your choice of stupid punks with something to prove, I said it with belligerence, a trait ever cultivated by fools. I said it, I tremble to admit, as Israel Finch might have. And predictably, chaos accompanied belligerence into office. For that putting down the dog remark led Elvis to seek and pull from me other facts pointing to ill intent, that Davy already had his coat on to deliver vengeance when Dad stopped him, that Davy had been angry with Dad earlier when it seemed to him the locker room beating hadn't been nearly severe enough, that Davy, waiting on the stairs for his arrest after the shootings, had grabbed my wrist and spoken the words, "I meant to." With despair, I heard myself answer Elvis's inquiries, each answer seeming horribly convicting the moment it was uttered. Oh, I was a meek enough fellow now, but it didn't matter. Elvis drew these facts from me and unfolded them to view and laid them before the court like a series of bloody hankies. I saw it happening, but couldn't stop it. Humility came to me too late. I'm a living proverb. Learn from me. We went to bed jittery, faking weariness, even as Dad prayed over us for forgiveness and joy and a night of peace. Swede, in her sleeping bag, was clutching a box of steak knives stolen from the de Cuellar's kitchen. We shut our eyes, slurred our goodnights. The moment Dad left the room, Swede bounded up and pulled jeans over her pajamas. She strapped on a belt and stuck two knives in it, right and left. Gravely, she offered me the box. I chose two, and with grim aspects slid them in my belt. Swede crossed her arms. She might have sailed with Francis Drake. She said, "We are of a noble tradition, Reuben." I buttoned up a flannel shirt and drew blood from three knuckles, tucking it in. We'd have sneaked out then, except the adults decided to have their coffee in the living room. This was inconsistent and very probably the work of the Lord. The front door was in the living room, and we weren't likely to just waltz out through it. Trapped in mutinous, we worked our brains. "We'll go out the window," said Swede. But Mr. de Cuellar, in his efficiency, had put his storms up right on schedule. We sat down in misery. Mine counterfeit, I will admit. "I guess we'll have to wait," I said. It was fine. Outside, the trees were leaning their tops around in the wind. The pane was so cold it felt wet. But Swede was intent. "After they're asleep, then." Which, of course, was not what I meant by wait. I meant the rhetorical wait, as in wait till next year, or just you wait and see. "Oh, I'm sure they'll be up a long time," I said, thinking, "Oh, Lord, let them stay up." And don't you know, they did. After a while, we lay down on top of our sleeping bags, just to soften the weight, and the wind tumbled stuff around outside, and a fine freezing rain began against the window, and I began to dream that a small piglet sat beside me, brown and aloof, and bit me on the hip when I rolled over. Actually, it was one of the steak knives. I sat up to feel for blood. The house was asleep. Swede, too. She groused a little in a dream as I slipped the knives from her belt, but she didn't wake. The next thing I recall is Dad kneeling between my bag and Swede's, waking us before sunup, strangely. I remember Mrs. de Cuellar singing in her kitchen, and the excited music of pans and perking coffee, and there was an agitation in Dad's voice that made me think, just for a moment, that we were on our way west, the car packed and pointed toward the faint cries of geese, the thrill of the cold. Then I heard Dad say, his voice part of sleep, his voice coming off balance into my sleep like a man feeling into a dark room, "The sheriff was here an hour ago. Wake up, kids. The sheriff has been here, kids. Are you listening?" Davies broke out. A boy on a horse. The best of it, to Swede in particular, was that Davy escaped by pony. We wouldn't know this for several days, however. Nor would the disturbed sheriff, Charlie Pym, who'd showed up pounding the door in the wee hours. Over breakfast, Mr. De Cuellar told us how he'd wrapped himself in a tartan robe and peeked between curtains before opening the door. "Do you know who is up at 4 in the morning? Dairy farmers? Paper boys? Lunatics?" Mr. De Cuellar was not himself this morning. He was, in fact, grouchy. It was indecipherable to Swede and me, to whom this news was cotton candy. Sheriff Pym had insisted on entering. The night was wet and freezing, and Pym stood dripping sleet on the rug, giving Mr. De Cuellar what he called the onus eye. I'm sure he meant the evil eye. The word onus made Swede break into such unruly giggles she had to hunt Kleenex. The sheriff then inquired whether Mr. De Cuellar had slept well. "Thus far," Mr. De Cuellar replied. "No visitors?" the sheriff said. Mr. De Cuellar looked at the door, then at the soaked Pym. He said, "You can't possibly believe he would have come here." So all we knew that first morning was that David got out, maybe 7 hours before. We hadn't details except that he'd taken with him a police-issue revolver and that a posse had been formed. 12 men in 6 cars were out parsing the county at this moment. "We'll have him by lunchtime," the sheriff said, looking at Dad, who was standing in his long johns in the gloom. "We'll try not to hurt your boy." It was Swede's contention, as the morning stretched on, that a posse of 1,200 couldn't catch Davy. Let him try. Dad said, "Swede, if you can't talk sense, don't talk at all." They were the harshest words I'd ever heard him speak. I watched him sipping his coffee, his face foreign with misgiving. How I wanted to understand him. But I was 11, and my brother had escaped from the pit where my vanity had placed him. A vain notion itself, Swede has since pointed out. Yet it was certainty to me. How could my father not be joyous over such a thing? Who in this world could ask for more? Nevertheless, the following days must have been excruciating for Dad, dreading Davy's recapture, yet fearing worse. The state police were advised, and locally the posse grew exponentially. After early radio reports of the escape, 50 men appeared at the courthouse, every one of them armed. Such a profusion of goose and varmint guns and beat-up World War pieces you never saw. At least such was the description given us by Deputy Walt Stockard, whose unconcealed glee over the escape must have been repugnant to Sheriff Pym. Though the very word posse sounds archaic, it made all sorts of sense at the time. For one thing, Davy was believed to be on foot, since no one in Montrose County had reported a stolen vehicle, not a car, not a tractor, not so much as a Schwinn. It was assumed he was still nearby, shivering in some hidey hole. "Unless he got out to the highway and hitched a ride," Dad suggested. He was trying to sell Walt on calling off the posse, something Walt hadn't the authority to do anyway. It was Davy's second day out. Walt was off duty and had come by the De Cuellars for coffee. No doubt the sheriff thought it wise to keep an eye on Davy's family. "He could be in Kansas City by now," Dad said. "Possibility," Walt admitted. "Though Pym believes otherwise. It was raining buckets, you know. How many folks are going to stop for some wet, muskrat-looking fellow in a rainstorm at that hour? Besides, he's got the best-known mug in the state right now. You think he'd try and hitch?" It was a good point. In fact, Davy's picture was on the front page of that very afternoon's Minneapolis Star. A shot of him relaxed and laughing, hands folded back of his head. I still don't know where they got that photo. It's the one they'd used in their earlier stories, the ones extolling his bravery. Later, they'd replaced it with a police mug in which his chin looked dirty, and his eyes gave you not one bit of hope or information. Now the flattering picture was back, with this caption. "Bold outlaw Davy Land slips from jail, eludes manhunt, fellow inmate. He up and disappeared like smoke." Good grief, Dad said. Having up and disappeared, David clearly reacquired the allure that had evaporated so easily when people heard about Bubby. Now he was back to bold outlaw. And while I liked the change, I'd also learned a bit by now about public inconstancy, not to mention Mighty Stinson's inconstancy. Quoted at length by reporters, Mighty told the story as one smitten by legend.
And when I looked back up, he was flat out gone. I didn't hear a sound, like he was a ghost.
And worse. You know something? I knew he was going to do it. Knew it when they first brought him in. Pretty irresponsible of Mighty, since the truth, Walt said, was that Mighty had been sleeping like mortality itself when Davy made his move. But when else was anyone going to listen to a word Mighty said, much less put it in print? What actually happened, and we got this from Walt, whose colleague, Stube Range, was on shift, was this. Shortly before 11, Stube was sitting at the night desk reading a paperback mystery. Subsequent research has revealed the book to be a Mike Hammer detective story. Stube was reading it despite Sheriff Pym's disapproval of its author, Mickey Spillane. More research? The sheriff had met Spillane once, far back in memory, on a turboprop airliner, and Spillane had made a humorous remark about Charlie Pym's beard, which was sparse. Suddenly, Stube was distracted from the story by a polite call from Davy. The toilet in his cell wouldn't flush, he said. Don't flush it, then, Stube answered. There's a need to, Davy replied. Sorry about that, but there's a need. Davy jiggled the lever audibly. No flush. There was apparently some back and forth between them. Mighty Stinson snorting in his sleep through everything because the dampness stopped his nose. But finally, Stube Range put down his book, grumpy good-naturedly about it, I'm sure, let himself into Davy's cell, locked it behind him, and peeked in the toilet. No suspense here. Stube awoke, propped against the wall of Davy's cell. His head was sore and his memory flawed. The toilet, incidentally, worked fine. He had to use it before his replacement showed up at the stroke of 12 and released him from the cell. Swede would point out, rightly enough, that a man reading Mickey Spillane ought to have known better, but Stube Range, as they say, had a good heart. At this crossroads in his life, he would in fact leave law enforcement to begin a new career as a school janitor over in roofing. The district was hiring, you see. We stayed at the DeQuayars 3 days after Davy's escape. Walt visited every morning, asking jokingly whether we'd seen Davy lately, and bringing us news of the county's frustration. Crisscrossing the area, talking to farmers and rural delivery men, and others who might have noticed a bedraggled boy slouching hastily elsewhere, the posse had come up dry. The chase paled, posse members began to desert, offering as excuses their wives and families, and, in rare cases, their jobs. Who could blame them? Not only was the trail cold, there hadn't really been a trail to start with. By the time a bloodhound could be borrowed from a neighboring county, the great rains had blotted out Davy's scent. They gave the bloodhound a try anyway. Poor over-anticipated fella. He couldn't smell anything but himself. Through all this, Walt said, Sheriff Pym was losing his happy nature. Justly or unjustly, Davy had grown a higher profile than any other desperado ever to sit in the Montrose County Jail. His escape only raised it higher. Pym, Walt cautioned us, felt that people were laughing at him. He'd been heard shouting blue language at the phone in his office. A Minneapolis editorialist had thrown out the combustible phrase, "Ham-boned county rubes." "He's touchy what people think of him," Walt told us. "So you see, that Mickey Spillane business rings true." By Davy's third day, Sheriff Pym had become so out of sorts, Walt reported he was thinking of a house-to-house search. "It scares me, Mr. Land. Do you know how long it would take to look in every closet in Montrose?" Mr. DeQuayar said. "The sheriff is joking. It's unconstitutional." "Coffee?" The deputy accepted. "I'm worried about Charlie," he said. "He's just sure somebody's got Davy down the basement. Some young lady, he says. He keeps saying that. It bothers him awfully." Walt Stockard was beginning to look tired. "A lot of people like that boy, you know." "Yes," said Mr. DeQuayar, "they do." He was brisk this morning. There were times he seemed mad at Davy for getting away, or maybe he was just sick of house guests. It had been a pretty long visit. Walt said, "My girls have been treating me like I'm on the wrong team." "They'll recover," Mr. DeQuayar said. Walt pinched the bridge of his nose. What a kind fella he was. He looked capable of forgetting just about anything. He said, "Say, Rube, hand me one of those Bismarcks, would you?" That afternoon, to everyone's relief, a farmer, name of Nelson Svedvig, came into Montrose and filed a complaint about a stolen horse, an Arabian mare taken from his south pasture. This would be less than 2 miles from Montrose. "Taken when?" Sheriff Pym asked. Walt was standing right there, listening, is how I know.
"Oh, not sure," Nelson Svedvig admitted. "I hauled a load of hay out last week. She was there then."
He saw the sheriff looking at him and added defensively,
"Those ponies kind of look after themselves this time of year."
"Are your fences okay?"
"Could be she ran off," Nelson replied. "She foaled in the spring, and the foal is still there,"
adding with rising dignity,
"and you know my fences, Charlie."
That night, the sheriff paid off what remained of the dispirited posse, and we took our leave of the DeQuayars. Oh, it was good to get home. Our first night back, Swede propped herself in bed, typewriter before her, listing in quilts. At first, I worried she'd go back to fretting and banging the wall, but she whacked away steadily, and I soon dropped asleep in my room across the hall. Here's what I found in the morning, laid neatly on the floor beside my bed. The moon was black as a miner's lung, the sky was black as a shroud, and deep in a cell that was black as a well, two men lay moaning aloud. And one was Rennie, who'd robbed a man, and one was Bert, who had killed. And the gallows outside hadn't ever been tried, but its mission would soon be fulfilled. Lads, its mission would soon be fulfilled. Three nooses swayed loose in a breeze like a sigh, but who was the third who was waiting to die? Swede came in while I was reading and perched on my bed like a satisfied cat. She saw how breathless I was. It made her pretty confident. I said, "Is it Sonny?" But she only shrugged. She knew she had me. He'd been awake in his room one night, with his darling asleep by his side, when the bold Reddick boys, hardly making a noise, pushed the front door open wide. His bride they had threatened not once but three times, when his travels had fetched him away. They had followed her round as she walked through the town, calling names I would rather not say. No, the names I would rather not say. And what do you think any good man would do, no matter what judges or laws told him to? There was something about the poem. I almost felt I had read it before. "Swede," I told her, "this is awful good."
"Aw, don't," she said.
They opened the door and they crossed the broad floor, with their minds full of evil intent, for in town they had heard the fortuitous word that sundown on business was sent. And as they approached, Sonny rose to his feet, like a spirit he made not a sound, and his blood rose inside as they came near his bride, and he shot the bold Reddick boys down. Lads, he shot the bold Reddick boys down. So may a good man who has spared his wife hurt face death with the likes of poor Rennie and Bert.
That's it? I couldn't believe it. There wasn't any more? He dies? They hang him with these two guys? Reuben, how fast do you think I can write this stuff?
Oh, it's not done?
Reuben! Well, I'm sorry.
The truth was, old Sundown really tugged at me. Glad as I was that Swede was back in whatever groove made the verses click, this business of hearing half a story was insufferable. Cautiously, I asked, "What about Valdez?" She didn't look at me.
"What about him?"
"Well, what happened to him? Who are these Rennie and Bert fellas?" She looked at me hard. I figured she was thinking I didn't like the poem.
"Swede, it's a great poem. You know it is. I was only wondering."
She had tears in her eyes, just that quick.
"I love the poem, Swede."
I was desperate, partner.
She said, "Sonny couldn't beat him, Reuben. Valdez, I couldn't write it."
Now, why do you suppose that made me feel so bad? A lump arose, as if I was reading my own mawkish epitaph.
"So he got away?"
She didn't answer. Her silence placed or revealed a nub of fear in me, an unreasoning fear that Valdez was no invention, that he was real and coming toward us on solid earth. A preposterous idea, wouldn't you say? Yet it blazed up, so scary in its brightness, that I made a wall against it in my heart, in the deepest place I owned. The weeks wheeled along unbalanced. Swede leaned toward elation. She herself couldn't have orchestrated Davy's getaway in more fabled style. One day, Walt Stockard reported to us that the Svedvig mayor had come trotting home, wickering for oats but none the worse for wear. There was speculation that Davy'd ridden a dozen miles across country to the state highway and nabbed a ride. Swede also took satisfaction in the newspaper's reversal of attitude, by now so complete that a stranger reading his first Davy Land article would have finished it, believing the world was improved without these Finch and Bosca characters anyway, and that young Land ought merely to be thanked and let go. One columnist, Aaron W. Grope, at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, was particularly susceptible to romance. I've saved a couple of his entries. Here's part of one. Ride, Davy, ride. No fretting for the past for me, folks. I'm happy in the current century. Put me in a Lincoln Continental or a turboprop leaving frozen St. Paul. Give me Huntley Brinkley at 6 o'clock. Meet me at Met Stadium for a ball game on a summer night. I'm a modern creature, friend, and I like it that way. So how come I envy Davy Land? He's just a kid, after all, with an outdated sense of frontier justice. A kid who went too far and landed most deservedly in jail. A kid who exceeded the boundaries of our civilized lives. He ought to be locked up. Isn't that right? So how come when I arrive at work, the first thing I do is check the AP wire to see if Davy Land's been caught, and chuckle on seeing he hasn't? He's just a boy on a horse, after all, just a skinny length of wire and persistence, who still doesn't know he can't really escape. Such ignorance. For his face is known to every citizen. It's pasted to the dashboard of every state cop and county hack. I mentioned Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. If you saw the news last night, you know they know him too. A boy on a horse can't outride the law. Not in 1962. The police tell us so, and perhaps they are right. America is a grown-up place, after all. It's been a long while since we loved our outlaws. Perhaps the songs we knew as kids about Jesse James and Billy the Kid and the dirty little coward who shot Mr. Howard have no place in a world full of television and helicopters and rock and roll. Perhaps this is all for the best. Today is December 5th. Davy Land escaped from jail 12 days ago. I've just checked the wires, and he is still free. Excuse me while I chuckle.
You had to take Aaron Grope for what he was, of course. All but the very best columnists grabbed their causes with such operatic chokeholds. Anyhow, as Swede said, this sort of thing beat the pants off the Bubby story. There was no comfort in it for Dad, though. He seemed to believe he had lost his son forever, and the popular melodrama of it only made it worse. He stopped answering the telephone. He became restive and joyless. Many a night I woke to the murmur of paper and knew he was up, sitting in the kitchen with frayed King James. Oh, but he worked that book. He held to it like a rope ladder. I remember creeping out once when my breathing was poor, and there he was, Holy Bible on the tabletop and himself bent to it, his back cupped as a weasel's. When I tapped his arm, he sat up straight, his breath seizing a moment as if the motion hurt. I told him my lungs were tight. All right, Reuben. But he sat still, not rising to put water on the stove. What you reading? 91st Psalm. Does it help? He went to the sink and held a pan under the tap. He didn't answer, and I thought he wasn't hearing me. I repeated the question. Dad lit a burner. There must have been something on the bottom of that pan, for smoke and burnt smell twined up its sides. When the water boiled, he threw in baking soda, which foamed and subsided. I said, "You could read me a psalm if you want to, Dad." But he said, "Not tonight, Reuben. My head hurts so." In early December, a blizzard swept in off the plains and struck with what was measured on the flats as 27 inches of snow. This was the first in what became nearly a weekly cycle of snowstorms, some of them riven by lightning, a confounding phenomenon. Dr. Noakes, a medical student through much of the Great Depression, said he recalled lightning and snow mixed only once before, during a week of examinations. He said the snow came down not in flakes, but the approximate shape and size of corn kernels. And he said it preceded a spring that brought neither rain nor hope of rain. So dry were most Midwestern souls.
I thought that was an awful lot to remember from something as simple as lightning in a snowstorm. But Dr. Noakes laughed and said one day I too would remember hard winters in detail more voluminous than anyone would care to hear. I suppose he was right, and you don't give a chip dime for December of 62, but it was an epic season all the same, the drifts rising eventually past the kitchen window and up to the very eaves. In the afternoon, Swede and I, in layers of pants, would step from the highest snowbank onto the roof of the single-story addition, then climb to the peak and go skidding down the other side to land with a poof in the front yard. How we miss Davy. In such snow, he'd have led us into all sorts of thrilling and jeopardous traps. Our backyard would have been veined with tunnels and candlelit caverns. Our snowball wars would have been prolonged and ferocious. I remember one dream I had that winter. That Davy was home and climbing the roof with us, his leaps from the peak wondrously high, and in the dream the salesman, Tin Lurvy, was lying on his back in the snow, watching, admiration all over his face, and Lurvy was saying, "Oh my, look at him, goodness sakes, what leaping!" And here's why I remember that dream in particular, because Lurvy said, and this woke me up laughing, "I want to try that! Hey kids, can I try that?" We didn't go back to school, by the way. Pretty manipulative on our part. Dad hadn't the will to send us back if we truly didn't want to go, and we knew it. Preying on his depression, we made ourselves useful. We washed clothes, scrubbed floors, swept cobwebs, cooked soup. It's hard to ruin soup unless you run short of salt, and anyway, Dad wasn't picky. When he approached us one day with the reluctant suggestion that we return to school after the Christmas break, Swede revealed a breathtaking bit of strategy. Taking Dad into her room and displaying a stack of history and geography and arithmetic books more than a foot high. "From the library," she said, adding this handsome flourish. "I certainly don't want to lag behind my classmates." "Ah," Dad said, looking at me over Swede's head. He was on to her and wanted me to know it. He didn't send us back, though, despite the fact that the school books were but props. It wasn't as if we didn't read. While at the library, Swede had also checked out every Frank O'Rourke on the shelves, having finished the Big 50 long ago. O'Rourke, she confided, wrote much better westerns than Zane Grey. "It's his women. They don't talk all the time, and when they ride like men." While interesting, I didn't see what difference this made to the story. As a reader, I leaned more in the direction of pirates. Treasure Island simply didn't have any women, except for Long John's stanch negress, whom you never actually see. "It makes all sorts of difference," Swede said. She's a professor now, have I told you that? "Every Western is a love story, you see. In Zane Grey, the hero always starts off with the wrong girl, and she has eyes that are too close together, and she has a bad attitude, like a problem horse." "The wrong girl is like a horse?" "Usually a roan, a stubborn roan. The hero has had lots of horses, and this girl makes him remember that roan." So Westerns were love stories. Though I'd read several myself, I hadn't realized the truth of this equation. I didn't like the sound of it either. "Swede," I said, "Sonny's wife? She was the right kind of girl, wasn't she? Like one of O'Rourke's you were talking about." The question made her indignant. Sonny Sundown was no dummy, she said. He'd ridden some miles in his time. He would have never married a roan. I was glad to hear her say it. Last I'd read of Sonny, he had his hands full enough without that sort of problem. Till late in the night he had fought the good fight with his fear and had kept it at bay, and he dreamed of his wife and their satisfied life, and he woke to a wicked new day. Then he rose in his shirt and he nodded to Bert, who was empty and mute as a hole. But down on his knees, Rennie wept aloud, "Please have charity on a thief's soul. Lord, forgive my poor, dry-rotted soul." Three nooses swung loose as a clergyman prayed. Three men were marched forward, and two were afraid. Swede meant this to be suspenseful, of course, but even at 11 I recognized what had to happen next. Somehow, a woman had to come on the scene. You don't need many Westerns under your belt to know that. And she had to be young and black-eyed and lovely and touched by the bravery of the condemned hero. Then up the tight street came a rider so sweet. She was light as the dawn and as free, and her hair was as black as her stallion's back, and she parted the crowd like a sea.
"Is it Sonny's wife?" I asked.
"No, just a woman," she deliberated. "You know, that's not an awful idea, but it's a different woman."
This troubled me, for I saw straight off that the beauty on the black horse was about to attempt a rescue, and also that she was deep in love with our Sonny.
And him married?
It was a problem.
"Why don't you change it?" I suggested. "Make this girl his wife. See, they ride away together."
"She wasn't his wife," Swede flared. Past tense, you notice. History, even the fictive kind, being beyond our influence. The problem got worse when the girl actually pulled off the rescue, for then Sonny, though rushed in the moment, leaned down from the black and pushed her hair back and kissed his deliverer twice. My lads, he kissed his deliverer twice. The last thing I wanted was to fight Swede, but this was terrible.
"Now he's kissing her?" I complained. "If she was his wife, it would be okay."
"Reuben," Swede said, holding herself back, "say you're about to be hanged. The rope's on your neck already. Then out of no place, this beautiful girl comes riding up and saves you. Are you telling me you're not going to kiss that girl?"
"Well, look, Reuben, let's say Sonny just thinks of her as a really great sister, like me."
I nodded, but in truth, this picked at me for some little while. Hair, as black as her stallion's back? Nuts. It would have been hard enough to think of that girl as a sister without throwing kisses into that deal at all. By the grace of Lurvy. Christmas 1962 looked a little meager going in. You understand, kids of my generation grew up with stories of their parents' deprivations, tales of treeless Christmases, cold kitchens, scrawny old stockings containing naught but a polished apple. In 1962, the Great Depression was a reach back of less than 30 years, surely a millennial distance for residents of a progressive city such as Minneapolis, but not so far if you lived in roofing, on the edge of the plains. Thus, Swede and I felt certain we were about to live such a story ourselves. For Dad had found but irregular work. He repaired a furnace for the Lutheran church, mended furniture in the basement, and, capitalizing on a rash of chimney fires in town, borrowed a brush and swept chimneys until he caught cold.
"I'll work through it," he told Swede, sniffing the hot lemonade she handed him.
But another day on the rooftops drove the cold lungward until he wheezed as badly as I did. I suspect he was almost grateful. I know we were. That chimney business was nasty work. The wind snapping his coat around, him up there in his janitor's boots, traipsing on icy shingles. Still, an unemployed father meant the sort of Christmas Swede and I had always heard of, or read about in books with titles like Days of Despair. We pictured ourselves waking Christmas morning to bowls of oatmeal unadorned by so much as a teaspoon of white sugar. "Porridge," Swede said. "Mush, gruel." We wondered how well we'd do in front of Dad, how grateful we could appear for a gift of, say, a navel orange. In the books, kids were unfailingly thrilled by a Christmas orange. They never felt poor at the time. It only dawned on them later. What I really wanted that year was the Spartacus model. Remember Spartacus? I never actually saw the movie, which came out, I believe, in 1960. But in 62, certain kids at school were still talking about its gory gladiator scenes. The dime store downtown had a model Spartacus. What a durable character he appeared, face like a badger's, sword in hand. And what a noble cause he espoused, fighting against slavery, like Abraham Lincoln. What a boy really liked about the Spartacus model was that one of the plastic pieces was a severed hand, belonging, I guess, to the fellow he just got done fighting. You could lay the hand anywhere around Spartacus's feet, or impale it on his sword, or paint it red and torment your sister with it. Swede wanted something even more extravagant.
"A trip," she said, "out west. I want to ride west on a horse and find Davy."
She was sure he was out there, cozy under some rock, sitting on a blanket, eating buffalo meat, holed up somewhere in the previous century. How great it would be to go find him. What a Christmas we'd all have. A navel orange just seemed a little weak in comparison. Then, 10 days before Christmas, Dr. Noakes stopped by. Drinking tea, our coffee was long gone.
He grew alarmed at Dad's deepening cough. He set his cup down and retrieved a stethoscope from his car.
"Jeremiah," he said warily, "how long have you been croaking this way?"
"I actually think it's getting better," Dad said.
"How much do you bring up?" asked Dr. Noakes.
Dad cleared his throat and said he hadn't been measuring.
Then, "Swede, Reuben, is your homework done?"
We hadn't any homework, of course, but we went to my room anyway. I remember noticing a strange smell right then, a heavy staleness in the air. Why hadn't I perceived it before? Air itself can rot, you know, turn lush as a forgotten peach. You want to throw open every window you see. On the way to my room, we heard Dr. Noakes ask, not fooling around, "What color?" He's told me since, Dr. Noakes has, that his main worry was not Dad's pneumonia. He was confident antibiotics and Dad's own constitution could handle that. What worried the doctor was that I might come down with it. A set of lungs like mine could turn to peat moss with very little prompting. Before leaving that night, Dr. Noakes stepped me aside and spoke in confidence.
"Reuben," he said, "I have a hunch about your sister, that she has the makings of a doctor when she's grown. So listen, you stay out of her way. Let her take care of your dad. What do you say?"
I know, I should have been far too old to fall for this sort of ruse.
"I've given her instructions, and I'll drop some medicine by. You let Swede give it to your dad. Your job is to stay out of his room. Swede should take him his meals, too."
He saw I didn't understand. Glancing around, he said,
"Bedside manner. It's where she needs practice. Her bedside manner is a little rough."
"Well, what can I do?" 2 weeks, Dad was supposed to stay in bed.
"What about Christmas?"
Dr. Noakes said, "You know, I was talking to Mr. Layton today. He's got a bad spine. Did you know that?" Talk about your conversational leaps. I blinked at Dr. Noakes, who went on,
"He just can't work anymore in certain ways. You're familiar with that old eyesore of a corn crib back of his house?"
I didn't understand what it had to do with Dad and said so. Dr. Noakes replied,
"Mr. Layton would probably hire a boy to tear that corn crib down, if the boy had a strong back, Reuben."
A strong back? I had never imagined myself with a strong anything. Even had I guessed that the doctor only wanted to remove me from the house, put my lungs outside in healthy air, I wouldn't have cared. No words he spoke could have pleased me more.
Gerard Layton's corn crib was indeed an artifact. Tall as a boxcar, nailed up of laths spaced on oak posts, it leaned back in time. I stood in front of it, holding a crowbar, not knowing how to begin. I mentioned the snow. This was December 16th, the birthday, Sweet informed me, of Ludwig Beethoven, the great band director, and already we'd logged 3 or 4 notable snowstorms. Winter was a train crawling north. I walked all around Mr. Layton's corn crib, up to my hips every step. It seemed an odd time of year for this particular job, but Mr. Layton was peculiar, and everyone knew it. I remember thinking the corn crib looked about 10 minutes from falling over on itself, but when I poked the crowbar through its ribs and leaned down, nothing happened. The crib flat out did not notice me. I heaved to and fro. I had on Davy's chopper mitts with wool liners, but felt that bar as if barehanded. At last, after extravagant effort, a nail squealed and dropped me into a drift. Swede fretted over me appreciatively when I came in at noon.
"Oh, you're frozen. Hurry and get some dry socks on. I'll hang those on the radiator. Come on, Reuben. I've got soup ready."
She squared me at the table and set down a bowl of something white. Not what you think of as soup, though dumplings bobbed on the surface.
"It's villing," she announced.
I knew what it was. It was hot milk with a little sugar stirred in, also some butter and a shake of cinnamon. "Dad told me how to make it. I always liked it," Swede said. I didn't mean to hesitate, but I'd been out all morning doing a man's work. Villing was sick food.
"Isn't it okay?" Swede said.
"Do we have any cheese?" She shook her head. Off in his bedroom, Dad hawked something up, a dispiriting sound. I looked at the filling. If you skimmed the dumplings off, you had only to pour it over toast. Presto, milk toast. More sick food. Well, let's eat. By this time, I felt poorly used and didn't care how gruff I sounded. To work all morning in snow to my waist, to pit my muscles and manly crowbar against an edifice as stout as Mr. Layton's corn crib, to come home all dissipated and ravenous and have to sit down to a bowl of hot milk? Dad's worse, Swede said abruptly. What's the matter? He's in there pounding his chest. Hear him thumping? He's been doing it all morning. It was strange. My fingers started to tremble when she said that. It's his lungs. They're filling up, like yours do, Reuben. He's trying to knock it loose. Be right back, I told her. Wait, Reuben, you aren't going in, Swede said, but I was compelled by the whacking noise. Who knew constriction better than me? How many times had I thrashed my own chest, thrashed it like you would a snake, to make it slack its coils? Dad stopped pounding when I opened the door, sitting up in a flannel shirt, blankets over his lap, and on them an aluminum pan, his face when he saw me filled with chagrin.
I sound like a threshing crew. Ugh!
Is it hard to breathe?
Reuben, he said, is this what you feel like in the night?
His breathing was like ripples on a sand beach. Yes, sir. He nodded, exhausted but watching me, it seemed, more closely than usual.
What would you think of moving, Reuben? Dr. Noakes has told me.
He paused, breathed.
Of people who have this trouble. They've gone to dry climates.
He breathed again.
New Mexico. He says all this plumbing works better out there.
He slapped his chest. New Mexico?
High desert, he said.
And those words did sound magnificent, spoken as they were in a close, moist, ill-smelling room. High desert. It came to me as beautiful rolling wastes of sagebrush and grama grass and air through which you might see an antelope top arise 6 miles away. Just thinking of it relaxed me. Who could not breathe in such a landscape? Then Swede, who'd come in behind me, said,
What if we move and then Davy comes back and we're all gone?
Dad said,
Well, we don't have to make our minds up right now.
It would be like forsaking all hope of his return, Swede said.
I know the sentence deserved an accompanying swoon, but this is how she got sometimes, and by now you oughtn't to be surprised.
He'd find us, I argued. I was excited. I'd never seen high desert, but the thought of it seemed suddenly imperative.
Don't you think we ought to? It's out west, Swede.
I watched her thinking it out, imagining Davy returning, probably on horseback, knowing Swede's turn of mind, Davy finding us gone and turning his big black into the sun and walking away. But she was also thinking of us out west, the three of us riding across prairies, sighting each other like a family invented by Frank O'Rourke. And I watched her thinking how Davy would rejoin us there and we'd become the four of us again, and possibly even the five of us, an O'Rourke woman appearing now on a strong bay mare along